listen for hula music and track her down. Well, good afternoon, everyone. The Cleveland Plain Dealer, I've always loved the name, Plain Dealer. The Cleveland Plain Dealer's Minister of Culture, a writer named Michael Heaton, proclaimed last week the week of the Armstrongs. Because, of course, the astronaut Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, died, a very well-respected man and known all over the world, at least his name is. And then there was Lance Armstrong, who, regardless of what you believe actually happened, will be stripped of his Tour de France medals. And he's quite well known. It's sort of hard to know what to think about that because I don't know that we'll ever know the truth. And then Michael Heaton went on to mention his buddy Butch Armstrong, who was having quite a week himself, but I never heard of Butch Armstrong, and you probably never did either. It's unusual that we have reached a point in our history as a church where we have to explain to people who Herbert Armstrong was. I get together with the teens for a teen Bible study, and I mentioned the name Armstrong. I said, "Who do you think of when you hear the name Armstrong?" And it came up. Neil Armstrong came first and Lance Armstrong came second. And I had to tell them, even though they've grown up in your houses, who Herbert, I don't mean anything bad by that. They knew who Herbert Armstrong was. Oh, yes, they'd heard a whole lot about Herbert Armstrong. But the world doesn't remember him anymore. I picked up a recording, a video recording of the pianist Arthur Rubinstein, who did a concert before he died in Pasadena, California. And on the back, there's a picture of a man named Herbert Armstrong, comma, patron of the arts, handing him a piece of Steuben glass. But that's the only mention of him. Herbert Armstrong, patron of the arts. I'm not sure that he would mind being known that way. But the fact is that the world has pretty much forgotten who Herbert Armstrong is. And again, we have to explain who he is to people. There isn't that much on our website about him because he's not here anymore, as you may have noticed. He died, I think, in 1986. And so people here under the age of 26 were never alive when Herbert Armstrong was. That's hard to believe, but it's quite understandable that they haven't heard of him. And so when people become part of our church, many people, by the way, who do become part of our church today have heard of Herbert Armstrong and they put two and two together. But, you know, those people, as time goes by, will be fewer and fewer. And Bill, do you know who Herbert Armstrong is? Have you heard the name? Mark, have you heard the name Herbert Armstrong? Yes, so some people do, some people don't. The fact is that we are preaching the gospel, but none of us would be here if it wasn't for Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And going over the history of Mr. Armstrong, I met him and talked with him. I can't say I knew him. I'm not sure that he would have had any idea who I was other than momentarily. And there are other people in this room, the Thomases, Taya, maybe other people too, who have talked to Mr. Armstrong and worked with Mr. Armstrong. But of course, those were in the days when he was old and his hearing wasn't very good and his eyesight wasn't very good and his wife had died and there was constant turmoil in the people who were around him. You know, I knew him as a very good leader, a very good writer, a person who changed my life. My own personal encounters with him was, and forgive me in the world tomorrow, he was an old grump. I used to serve in the auditorium refreshments, and he would always come over and tell us how we had not lived up to what he had hoped we would do. And the champagne was never cold enough. And you know, he would, by that time in his life, he was concerned about the future of the church, so he was always yelling at us, saying, "You people don't get this. I'm not going to do an impression, although I've got the jowls for it. I've got that." But, you know, in his younger days, he was quite the dynamo and quite the writer and had quite an effect on the world. At one point, the Plain Truth magazine was the largest religious publication in circulation of its time, as was our TV broadcast. And of course, now we take different tasks and those statistics tax, and those statistics aren't quite as important. But in some ways, the name of Herbert Armstrong has disappeared. He was, for the record, the person who began the Worldwide Church of God. We spent a lot of time telling people we are not the Church of Herbert Armstrong, we're the Church of Jesus Christ. And of course, that's an important thing to say and true. But at the same time, a quote from a famous philosopher, who I will name later, says that all institutions are the lengthening shadows of one man. And in some ways, especially the Radio and Worldwide Church of God were the shadow of Herbert Armstrong, and that he founded the physical organization. Of course, he's been gone for some time. I think he would be very unhappy with what has happened since. His prophecies came true. We have squabbled and we have split, and I don't know that our numbers are smaller total in the world, but when you look at numbers of groups who are attending and our own little congregation, I mean, I was part of a congregation in Cleveland that sometimes hit 600 people and more on combined holy days, and this is us now. There are other groups meeting today too, but you understand that. We would not be sitting here today, regardless of what you think about the man, if it were not for Herbert W. Armstrong. However, we would also not be sitting here today if it were not for another man who had a huge influence on Herbert Armstrong. And today I want to tell you about that man and part of the debt that you owe to him, whether you know it or not. When we bought our first house in 1986, we moved to a street in Lakewood called Roycroft Avenue. And Roycroft didn't mean much to me in those days. Does it ring a bell for anybody here? Roycroft, do you know Roycroft? Well, I thought of it in terms, I knew I had heard the word before, and where I had heard it was in Mr. Armstrong's writings about a person who started a community in Western New York called Roycroft. In his autobiography, he mentions visiting the man and his community. The man's name was Elbert Hubbard. And how many of you remember this book, The Seven Laws of Success? It's not as such a religious book. It was first published decades and decades ago. This was a later edition of it. But much of the church's growth was built on this. Herbert Armstrong was a good salesman, and he would snag people because everyone wants to know laws of success, don't they? I certainly do. No, nobody comes into the world and says, you know, I would really like to be a failure. No one does that. Pretty much everybody wants to be a success. And most of this book is not linked to the Bible. Most of this book is just common sense reading and things that do lead to success. Of course, the seventh law of success is having the right foundation. And the spiritual foundation, living God's way, is how we would know it. And he pointed out that there are men who live by the first laws, you know, to have an education and to be resourceful and to persevere and things like that, but did not know the seventh. And one of the men that he mentioned was Elbert Hubbard. Now, I want to read to you what he wrote about Elbert Hubbard. He said, one important man I knew was Elbert Hubbard, philosopher, prolific writer, publisher, lecturer, known as the Sage of East Aurora. The Fra, as he sometimes styled himself, became quite famous. He wore semi-long hair under an extra-size hat and a string bow tie. He was said to be worth $500,000 at a time when that equaled $3 million or more on today's market. Now, this is a picture of Elbert Hubbard at that time. He didn't always look like that. I mean, you see pictures of him as a young man, and he looked pretty normal. Nobody dresses like this except maybe Buster Brown. Do you remember Buster Brown? There was another man, though, who dressed something like this because he fell under the influence of Elbert Hubbard. His name was Frank Lloyd Wright, who went on to have an influence on the world. Frank Lloyd Wright's son said of the two of them, never were there two men who spoke at each other more and listened to each other less. But they had their strong ideas, and they did rub off on each other. And Elbert Hubbard actually influenced Frank Lloyd Wright's work, particularly his home in Wisconsin, Taliesin. Anyway, to go on with Herbert Armstrong, Elbert Hubbard published two magazines composed mostly of his own writings, The Philistine and The Fra. Now, The Philistine, I have a number of copies. I brought a couple today if you want to look at them. These are from 1913. This was the Reader's Digest of its day. This is what, well, if you had indoor bathrooms, you might have read these in the indoor bathroom. I'm not real sure. They're short little articles with sayings and cartoons and things. They epitomized printing in their day. For instance, there's sayings on the front. It says, the smaller the think tank, the more room there is in it for a peeve. And he liked short sayings like that. They're also full of advertisements, which was one of his fortes. It says, your reputation is made by your neighbors, and like all creators, they make it in their own image. He liked to say things like that, and he would send them out on scrap paper with these magazines, and people would hang them in their offices or on their walls or things. He had quite a few sayings. He was a good writer. He could reach people. The Philistine, by the way, was his, the reason he named it the Philistine was he said he was an enemy of the chosen ones, meaning the establishment. He wanted to go after them. And people would read the Philistine, I think they called it, and they thought they were getting away with things. They thought they were being radical. The young people would read this while they were sitting behind the barn smoking, you know, and they would talk about it with their friends. And this was like the hip-hop of its day. It was a way to be cool and rebellious. And yet, it really isn't that bad. You read it today and you think, what was all that about? And then the other magazine, his flagship magazine, was The Fra. This is a picture of Elbert Hubbard on a horse on one of his magazines. I find these magazines fascinating. For one thing, he did 95% of the writing in them. He wrote all the advertisements himself. And also, they're just a cross-section of life in those days. And they're very interesting magazines just to read. Obviously, you can still pick them up, particularly in this area. The Fra, by the way, he called himself Fra Albertus. And that was his way of deflating the pomp involved in it. He spent a lot of time making fun of himself, which was one of his more endearing features. He encouraged people to joke about him. As a matter of fact, at his community one time, he did all the work. He may have been a rich man, but he lived just like everyone else, in the same kinds of rooms that everyone else did, with his wife. One time he was out front raking the front driveway, and a rich man came, because many people came to visit at the Roycroft Inn and campus, and looked around and saw this man standing there with the hat and the tie and all this stuff, and handed him the horse's reins and said, "Hold these, John, I've got an errand to run." And he ran in, and he was there to see Elbert Hubbard. So John was standing there holding the horses, and the man is in there, and he's saying, "Where's Elbert Hubbard? Where's Elbert Hubbard?" And finally, people led him out to the front porch and pointed to Mr. Hubbard, and the man was briefly embarrassed, but Elbert Hubbard roared with laughter. He thought it was funny. Well, from then on, the people in his community referred to him as John. Hey, John, especially when they wanted to make fun of him, something like that. And he actually loved it and went along with it. To continue what Mr. Armstrong wrote, he boasted of the largest vocabulary of any man since Shakespeare. He actually said he had a larger vocabulary than Shakespeare. He published An American Bible, that's the name of a book, shocking many of the religious, because he liked to do that, yet explaining that the word Bible merely means book, which it does, not necessarily sacred writings, unless the word holy is prefaced. His Bible consisted of his selection of choice writings from American authors. He included Franklin, Emerson, Paine, Jefferson, Lincoln, and of course, Hubbard. He allotted nearly half of the entire volume to the writings of Hubbard, and all other famous Americans combined shared the remainder. Hubbard was not the victim of an inferiority complex, and he preached a positive philosophy. He did have rare insight and wisdom in purely material matters, he really did, and a keen understanding of human nature. He knew that important men craved flattery as an actor enjoys applause. A large share of his fortune was made by writing an almost endless series of booklets captioned Little Journeys to the Homes of the Great and the Near Great. No one wanted to be in the second category. They all wanted to be in the first category. These were printed, of course, in rare style by his own Roycroft Press. Dozens and scores of America's rich and famous men paid Hubbard premium prices to write them up in his inimitable literary style. He made money doing everything that he did. An interesting sidelight on Mr. Hubbard's concept of success came spontaneously from his lips one Sunday afternoon. He and I were chatting at his Roycroft Inn in East Aurora, New York. Mr. Armstrong said, "I asked a Unitarian minister whether he had ever been able to discern just what your religious belief really is, if any. Fra Albertus was interested at once. And what did he say?" he asked curiously. "He said he wasn't quite sure, but he suspected that whatever your religion may be, it probably originated in your pocketbook and bank account." There was no denial. "Ho, ho," laughed Elbert Hubbard. "Well, I get away with it, don't I?" And that would be
Vintage Albert Hubbard. But was Albert Hubbard a real success after all? By human standards, I suppose he was. He knew and applied the first six of the seven laws of success. He worked hard and industriously. He reaped a bounteous harvest of money, popularity, and acclaim. And then he goes on to say, if I can get the page turned, but his fame did not appear to last. One seldom hears of him anymore. Hubbard knew material values, but his agnosticism closed the door and threw away the key that led to an understanding of spiritual values. He never quite understood the real purpose of life itself. He didn't know the seventh law of success. He didn't know man's real potential destiny. And not knowing or following that seventh rule, he drove himself by diligent practice of the six in the wrong direction, diametrically away from true success. Well, reality being the strange thing that it is, today the situation is turned on its head. Very few people have heard of Herbert Armstrong. Meanwhile, Albert Hubbard's Roycroft Inn and campus is enjoying a renaissance. It's having quite an effect on all kinds of parts of our society. You can go visit it, by the way. It's about 3.5 hours away. I've always marveled that people go visit churches where Sabbath keepers once kept services, and you know, they like that link to our church, but you can't really prove a link between our church and them other than the fact that they kept the Sabbath. That's a very important link, by the way. Whereas for Albert Hubbard, we have a direct link. Herbert Armstrong went to visit Albert Hubbard, and he said it was to fulfill a dream of his. He really wanted to meet Albert Hubbard. When he was a young man, his uncle Frank Armstrong told him to study the writings of Albert Hubbard for vocabulary and for writing style. And Albert Hubbard, if you read his writing, and I hope you will browse in some of these, you could almost be reading the writings of Herbert Armstrong. He picked up his style and then some. And one of the things that both of them could do would be to just send a riveting beeline arrow right into your brain and grab your attention from the very beginning. As I think was Mr. Herbert Armstrong's biggest gift, is that in his headlines and those little lines underneath, there's a word for those, and I can't remember, you know, the slightly bigger print underneath the headlines. He had you by that time. That's the reason that he was a success. He honed that in advertising, and he honed his advertising skills, as did most young men of the era, I might add, by reading the writings of Albert Hubbard. You read any of those writings, and you realize what people owed to this man. He was very funny, by the way, very irreverent. He did not hold any value to organized religion. He wasn't that crazy about colleges and things like that. He grew up in Illinois and became a soap salesman. That's how he began. He worked for the Larkin Soap Company. Now, everybody needs soap. Whether you have running water or not, you still need soap in American society. And soap is soap. So he realized early on that it was the way you sold it that made a difference. And Albert Hubbard had a natural charm, which he also cultivated. And he said, when I came on a train into town, by the time I left, everyone in my car and the conductor was my friend. And when I got off, the waitresses fought over who got to fuss over me. And I held the whole town in the palm of my hand. And, you know, you think, well, he may have thought that. I wonder what other people thought. But his sales receipts bear it out. The man sold more soap than anybody else in the company. And he developed the concept of attaching premiums to it, you know, a free little China figurine if you buy so much soap. If you sell it to your neighbors, you can earn a desk or another piece of furniture or something like that. And pretty soon, the Larkin Soap Company of Buffalo, New York, was the biggest soap company in the world, even bigger than Ivory in its day. As I said, it was in Buffalo, New York, so he eventually moved there. He was fabulously rich by the standards of his day. He had a beautiful wife and four children, and eventually moved to the little town, not too far from Buffalo, of East Aurora, New York, because it was full of horses, and he really liked horses. And that's why you often see him riding a horse. He was a horseman from the time he was a little boy. As a matter of fact, he said, when I was young, I could, with only my straw hat, jump on the back of any horse bareback and get them to follow me. He said, of course, I always picked the old mare or the plow horse because I was a practical person, meaning a horse that wouldn't buck and run away from him. But he always liked to be on horseback. He
In 1895, he was dissatisfied, and he came to a point in his life where he'd made all the money he wanted to make, and he didn't know what to do. He was looking for answers, like many people, like Herbert Armstrong later. And he sold out his share in the soap business for about $75,000, which was a huge fortune in those days. As he said, I had in more money that I could spend the rest of my life. And he started traveling. He started going overseas. He went to England and met a man named William Morris. Now, I don't know if you've heard of William Morris, but William Morris was the founder of the arts and crafts movement in England. And William Morris wanted life to return, to get away from the industrialization and the Victorian filigree and fanciness, and to get back to simpler roots and you know, the common people and publish books for them and make home furnishings for them. Well, as the English did, he did make home furnishings, beautiful wallpaper patterns that are still used today. The Morris chair is named after William Morris. He published books, and that's very important. Beautiful editions. The only problem was the only people who could afford any of these things were the aristocracy that he was rebelling against. So he caved, and it became a rich man's movement. Well, Hubbard was touched by it, though. He tried to meet William Morris. It's not certain whether he ever did or not, but he certainly read his writings and followed his example and came home and in East Aurora started doing his own writing and his own printing. He wrote novels, and as his publisher said, trying to be kind, Elbert, they're not half as bad as you think they are. No one read them. He cranked them out. But he was not a very good writer, of course. He hadn't found his calling at that point. So he did start his magazines, The Fra and The Philistine, and he grabbed the American public because he basically used his soap-selling techniques to reach their minds. And he, you know, was starting to think in terms other than American big business, although he was also a friend of big business. He was an enigma in many ways. And people started, of course, following what he wrote, his circulation was in the millions even in those days. And then he wrote a piece called A Message to Garcia, which appeared in the Fra magazine. How many of you have heard of A Message to Garcia? A Message to Garcia in its day was about a man who was to deliver a message to a general in Cuba, but he didn't know where the general was. And he stopped at nothing until he had delivered that. And it ends, you know, we need more men who can carry a message to Garcia. I remember Mr. Raymond McNair loved that. A message to Garcia. Well, it's almost unreadable today. It's just maudlin. I mean, you can read it yourself and you think, oh, groan. Did people really like that? Well, yes, they did. It's sold by the millions in reprints. You could get a paper copy for 20 cents or a leather luxury bound volume for only a dollar plus postage. That's the way that Elbert Hubbard was. He made money off everything he did. And the railroad companies ordered it by the hundreds of thousands. The government of Russia, which was the Tsars in those days, ordered many copies, in Russian, of course, and distributed them to their people. There was that little thing about the Russian Revolution, so it makes you wonder how much of a hold it took. But industrialists and status quo loved it. And it really did outsell any other publication till its day. He was definitely the most famous writer in the English-speaking world. And yet, what do you know of his today? Almost nothing. But people were affected by it. And he started printing the books in luxury editions, and they became very coveted in the libraries of well-to-do people. Beautiful bindings, beautiful hand illustrations. The printing itself was beautiful. They were all marked with his symbol, which was like this. He claimed that this was a medieval symbol that monks put on their manuscripts after they had finished them. Well, that's one of those Hubbardisms that we can't really verify. He named his press the Roycroft Press after a couple of brothers from the 17th century, and he said it meant the king's crafters, the people who made beautiful things fit for a king. Well, what Roycroft really means is that poor farmers who live on crofts that happen to belong to the king. But Elbert Hubbard was not above turning a phrase to his own use. And so that's what Roycroft, if he said it meant people who make things fit for a king, then that's what it meant. And actually this symbol, if you notice, is a combination of all the letters in the word Roycroft. And that's really where it came from. You have to work pretty hard to get to the Y, but it's there. And an R was just too hard at all, so he just stuck that underneath. It gets used twice in the word Roycroft. Very practical. And things stamped with that today are worth thousands of dollars. Go on eBay and just type in Roycroft. First, type in Herbert W. Armstrong and see how much his books are selling for. I know because I bought this on eBay. 70 cents. Postage was $3.99. This magazine, old magazine, you can get for about $7. If you want a set of china from the Roycroft Inn, Tay and I were looking and laughing at a $2,000 china service that you can still get, by the way. As far as I know, it's still on eBay. Wait till sundown, but you can still get it. At the highlight of his community, which became the Roycroft community, people came to him by the thousands. Craftsmen, coppersmiths, blacksmiths, writers, painters. And there were so many people that he had to build housing for them. He could afford it because by now he was on the lecture circuit as a famous author. He would go from town to town and drum up incredible audiences who would pay incredible amounts. He was very proud of the fact that in San Francisco, the clergyman banned him from speaking there. And so he was to receive $100 for that speaking engagement, which was a large sum in its day. So he went to a hall next door, booked it, and made $500 selling tickets. And he publicly thanked the clergy for banning his appearance in San Francisco for that. When he spoke at Yale, everyone in the audience showed up dressed like this. And again, he roared with laughter and insisted on having his picture taken in the middle of the audience. He loved things like that. I'm not sure he took this outfit too seriously. I think it was marketing for him. He had to build an inn because so many people came to see him. In the Fra, the phrase was, "Hop on the train to East Aurora, where we work for art and glory." And people came by the droves, and that's how the Roycroft Inn started. He had to build an inn to house all the people who came to see him. And of course, charge people appropriately per night's stay. As I said, he made money off everything he did. But he believed in what he was doing. And there was passion, and there was art. And there was even a kind of love, which he spoke openly of, that people had a spirit, that they created beautiful things. And he brought in lecturers, and he had a music room with three Steinway grand pianos. And people, even the common craftsmen, came to these lectures and got their own kind of education. He never touted it in his writings, but he was known in Western New York for taking in people with criminal records, people who were difficult to place because of difficult family situations, handicapped, blind, deaf, what we call fallen women, women who'd had children and were not married. He would give them jobs. And yet, he would also educate them and turn them into people with a character and with a compass. And about this time, in the early 1900s, a young man named Herbert Armstrong decided that it was time to drop in on Elbert Hubbard. And you read the account, and I encourage you to read the account in his autobiography, because it was clearly something Mr. Armstrong wanted to do. And he walked in, and he had met Elbert Hubbard before, and Elbert Hubbard actually recognized him. When Elbert Hubbard had someone new at his place, the way he would test them out was he would make them go for a walk with him, or make them ride a horse or saddle a horse just to see what they could do. That's how he sized up people. He didn't have them submit applications or anything. And so Herbert Armstrong walked out on the side porch and he got hit in the head with a medicine ball, a big recreational ball thrown at him by Elbert Hubbard and his daughter and some of the other people. And can you imagine Herbert Armstrong playing ball in Western New York? But there he was, and he loved it. And then at the end, they all went down to the basement, and he put everybody to work. Elbert Hubbard lined them up and had them pack goodie bags. Herbert Armstrong said his job was to wrap Idaho potatoes in paper and put them in these boxes. His farms were so successful that he sold the food and shipped it all over the country. So Herbert Armstrong was put to work. And Elbert Hubbard said at that point, "I wonder what you think of me." And Herbert Armstrong said, "Well, I pretty much made up my mind already, but what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, here I am, you know, you're a guest of mine, and I'm putting you to work, and I'm charging you a huge price to stay here. Can't you stay another day?" And Herbert Armstrong said, well, he had business things to take care of, and he left. But
Later on, you find in his writings that he quotes Elbert Hubbard left and right. As a matter of fact, whenever he had a random quote, like success is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, which came from, anybody know who said that? Thomas Edison. He would say, well, as the great philosopher Elbert Hubbard said, and Elbert Hubbard probably did say it, so it wasn't necessarily a lie, because Elbert Hubbard stole everything he could get his hands on and printed it and signed his name to it. That was the American way at that point. So if you Google Elbert Hubbard, Herbert Armstrong, you find that he crops up in all kinds of articles that Mr. Armstrong wrote. And he would just say, as the noted philosopher Elbert Hubbard said, and then he would just rail off the quote. He may have said it, he may not have, but in Mr. Armstrong's mind and memory, he was the philosopher that he remembered. As I said, Herbert Armstrong's writing, which gripped the readers who read it, I can't say it gripped the entire world, what would happen was it would grab your mind. Tim didn't drink out of these, so they're both for me, aren't they? Teo thought there was an insect floating in one. I don't see him. If it's a grasshopper, we're okay. anyway, you see the influence that Elbert Hubbard had on Herbert Armstrong all through his life and on our church culture and on the way things were done. Elbert Hubbard had a campus. What did Herbert Armstrong have? 3 campuses. Elbert Hubbard had publications, the Fra and the Philistine, with provocative names meant to grab people's attention and make them think. What did Herbert Armstrong have? The Plain Truth, which when you think about it is a very weird name for a religious magazine, but it was a great name. Nowadays it's languishing. There may be people here who've never heard of the Plain Truth, but the Plain Truth magazine was our flagship. And Herbert Armstrong did much of the writing in it himself. His vocabulary reflects Elbert Hubbard's quite a bit. His passion for culture and the arts reflects Elbert Hubbard. He talks about when he visited there that he and 2 other piano players played the 3 Steinway grands together while everyone danced, including Elbert Hubbard. Again, can you picture that? Can you picture Herbert Armstrong, the Herbert Armstrong you knew, playing waltz music while Western New York dances by? I think it's a charming vignette. But Herbert Armstrong was, of course, devoted to culture and the arts. And near the end of his life, as you may recall, Mr. Armstrong, one of the ways that the gospel was preached was he went and talked to world leaders whom other people couldn't get an audience with. And some people say, well, we bought our way into those. But have you ever tried buying your way into visiting a prime minister or a president? I mean, you might reach somebody, but they're not interested in people like that. You know, you'll still get turned away. Somehow God opened the doors and he went to visit these people. And what did Mr. Armstrong call himself? Do you remember? He was an ambassador without portfolio. Now, have you ever heard anyone else call themselves an ambassador without portfolio? I never had. And I considered it a confusing phrase. A portfolio is the briefcase that the ambassador carries with his instructions and his mission in it when he goes to visit people. But of course, Herbert Armstrong wasn't commissioned by any government. Of course he was. He was commissioned by the government of God, but he wasn't commissioned by any earthly government to do that thing. So he referred to himself as an ambassador without portfolio, which, as you know, is a curious phrase. Elbert Hubbard, near the end of his life, and Mr. Armstrong talks about this, in 1915, of course, World War I was brewing, and the Kaiser Wilhelm was responsible for the unrest and the horrible things that were going on in Europe. Elbert Hubbard decided, as a person who had the attention of the United States, and of course without the United States, the outcome of World War I would have been much different. So the world was also watching the United States. Elbert Hubbard announced that he was going to Europe. And as a matter of fact, if you read this this last issue of the Fra when he was alive, which was in May 1915, he talks about he has scheduled seminars where a famous personage will be coming back from Europe to tell people updates on all that's happening over there. Well, the famous person was clearly him. He had planned to go over there and glean information, but he also decided that he would seek an audience with Kaiser Wilhelm himself as an ambassador without portfolio. He coined that phrase. He was he also called himself an emissary without portfolio. Now, unfortunately,
Kaiser Wilhelm wasn't privy to all of this, and Elbert Hubbard and his wife in 1915 boarded the Lusitania, which, unknown to the passengers, was loaded with ammunition for the European forces. And the German government announced that Americans on any of these boats should consider themselves at risk, that the German government would do everything they could to sink those and to cut off the European forces. Elbert Hubbard went anyway with his wife. He actually gave a curious farewell. He called it a sermon. And he didn't give sermons. He was very anti-religious. But he actually became emotional and said goodbye to people before he left and put his son, Elbert Hubbard II, in charge. Even more curiously, in the 1890s, he had published something in the Fra and said, "Watch the Irish Sea. It's known for burying its corpses. Check the obituary columns." And no one, you know, what does that mean? Well, in 1915, the Lusitania was shelled by German forces and sank in the Irish Sea. Elbert Hubbard and his wife Alice went down and drowned in that. At first, people couldn't believe it because he was such a public figure. But supposedly, they went back to their stateroom, that they were standing there and people were boarding lifeboats. But people did survive, by the way, but there wasn't enough room in the lifeboats, and supposedly he took Alice by the arm, and they went back to their stateroom, and that was the last anyone saw of them. He had been influenced by Levi Strauss and his wife on the Titanic, who were known to have gone down with the ship together, and he had actually written about that. So I don't know if he had contemplated that in advance, but it was a pretty Hall of Fame way to go. And even his enemies came and spoke kind words, and he had many enemies in East Aurora, New York, at his memorial service. The Roycroft Inn lasted for about another 30 years, mostly on the writings of Elbert Hubbard being sold, because this utopia on earth lasted only as long as his income lasted, really. And it was amazing that it lasted as long as it did, and then it fell into disrepair and was sold. Because I've had such an interest in it, I actually own a spoon from the Roycroft Inn. But it has the Roycroft logo on it, and I'm very happy to own this spoon. It kind of reminds me of Mr. Thomas last week talking about the Babylonian king who brought out the utensils from the temple. Well, this is my utensil from those days. I doubt if Elbert Hubbard ever ate with this spoon. I think the reason I was able to get it was probably someone in East Western New York pocketed it and took it home. And then it was being sold in an estate. And since I can't afford the $2,000 for the china, I bought a spoon. But for a long time, everything was sold off. Now the inn has been restored. If you go on the internet and look up roycroftcampus.com, they have a full schedule of activities. The buildings are all rebuilt. Tay and I have visited there. The shops are wonderful, and it's a very interesting town. He influenced furniture making so much that when you go into Target and buy Mission furniture, you're buying furniture that his people designed the basic feeling of. Interestingly enough, the arts and crafts movement, which started in the Roycroft community, gripped the country because, again, the whole country was interested in getting away from Victorian curlicues and things like that. It didn't last forever. It was replaced by Art Nouveau later on, but it still is affected today. And one of the strongholds, interestingly enough, for the arts and crafts movement is Pasadena, California. There's the Green and Green Mansion out there that is considered one of the absolute showcases of arts and craft homes and arts and craft furnishings. And, of course, everything that Frank Lloyd Wright did owes a debt also to Elbert Hubbard and his craftsmen. Now, Elbert Hubbard never designed a piece of furniture in his life, but he brought all the people together and made it happen. You can be a king, Mr. Swope. All you have to do is have the right people working for you, honest and truly. That's how our house works. I have the right people living with me who help make it happen. But I wonder sometimes if it will not, if this debt that we owe to Elbert Hubbard and his Roycroft campus through the history of our church will not come into play in the future. Because his motto was hand, head, and heart. Everything that his people made was designed in the head, made by the hand, and yet people put a little bit of their heart in it. And as much of a huckster as he was in many areas, he really did believe in that. There was a very fine documentary done for PBS 2 years ago. I own it. I don't want to lend it out. I want to keep it in my house. If you want to come over and watch it, you may, but libraries have it, on Elbert Hubbard and the Roycroft community. And I strongly urge you to watch it if you have any interest in it. It's presented a lot more interestingly than I can do and a lot more fully, and he was a very complex man. But we know that we are only in a holding pattern right now, and I would like you to turn to Psalm 108. Right now, we seem to be between areas of major activity. We are doing everything the way God instructs us. We are preaching the gospel, but we are not seeing great rewards at this point. I mean, you just have to look it in the eye and face that, that we are doing what we can, but the reason we're not is that God is not bringing it to us. It doesn't really matter what we do. If God wanted things to grow 100-fold, they would grow 100-fold. We have to do our part, and we are doing our part. But the growth comes from God, and that's why it's important to pray about the Kingdom of God seminar coming up. But in Psalm 107, but you're right there. Psalm 107 is interesting in its own right. It talks about the ways that God saves people, and the way it's written, you wonder if it had anything at all to do with the time it was written in and whether it wasn't geared towards today. But one of the things in it that reminds me very much of the community in Pasadena where Tay and I lived, where the Thomases lived, where many of you have been, in these words, it reminds me a great deal of it because, you know, Mr. Armstrong, it was a community. We had craftsmen, we had carpenters, we had all kinds of tradesmen there, we had gardeners. I think, didn't you work on the electric committee? I did landscaping out there, some of the most beautiful landscaping, award-winning landscaping you ever saw. And these verses in Psalm 107 always reminded me of it, talking about God, not Herbert Armstrong. Verse 33, he turned rivers into a desert, flowing springs into a thirsty ground, fruitful land into a salt waste because of the wickedness of those who lived there. And that part of the world was a desert. But this reminds me of what Mr. Armstrong built out in Pasadena. In verse 35, he turned the desert into pools of water and the parched ground into flowing springs. There he brought the hungry to live, and they founded a city where they could settle. They sowed fields and planted vineyards. They yielded a fruitful harvest. He blessed them, and their numbers greatly increased, and he did not let their herds diminish. And when we lived out there, people would just show up and want a job and want to be part of this headquarters of this work that was going on. It happened all the time. And you know, people out there were famous for their gardens. When I think of Dr. Herman Hay, who was one of the evangelists, I still think of goats. I mean, he would milk them and bring the milk in and offer you a drink, and he would have his produce from the garden. And many people out there lived in just the way that's described here. It was a village. It was a community. And even in the very worst times, there were very good things going on there. But, of course, much has changed. And in verse 39, then their numbers decreased, and they were humbled by oppression, calamity, and sorrow. He who pours contempt on nobles made them wander in a trackless waste, but he lifted the needy out of their affliction and increased the families like flocks. The upright see and rejoice, but all the wicked shut their mouths. So the community is gone, but God still upholds the people who are living his way. There's no question, even as he does today. If you turn to the book of Haggai, which is the third to the last book in the Old Testament, three books before Matthew. The name Haggai comes from the same word as the word feast. Haggai's name had a lot to do with that kind of thing, and he's talking about a time when things look fairly bleak, but a house needs to be built. And in Haggai, Chapter 1 and verse 2, this is what the Lord Almighty says. These people say, the time has not yet come for the Lord's house to be built. Then the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Is it a time for you yourselves to be living in your paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? Now this is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. You have planted much, but harvested little. You eat, but never have enough. You drink, but never have your fill. You put on clothes, but are not warm. You earn wages only to put them in a purse with holes on it. And remember that these people were standing at the site of the old ruined temple when these words came to them, that they had seen that work. The author of Hebrews, in an interesting twist, which I could talk about at another time, shows that the book of Haggai is an end-time book, that it is a historical book, but also that it has application to the end time. And God tells the people to work. In verse 9, he says, "You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why, declares the Lord Almighty? Because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with his own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew and the earth its crops. I called for a drought on the fields and the mountains, on the grain and the new wine, the oil, and whatever the ground produces, on men and cattle, and on the labor of your hands." Now, we know about droughts for crops, but what kind of drought affects the labor of your hands? What he's saying is that I'm really in charge of the growth, and you people need to be behind me. And, you know, I am very proud to be part of the United Church of God and very grateful to be part of it. It has given me a home, and I feel that it is doing the work in very significant ways. But again, we don't have that campus, do we? We don't have the beautiful landscaping and the physical buildings and the auditorium and the figurehead. We don't have one person that we're living in the great shadow of as part of his institution. So I miss those old days, I have to confess. But God gives us good news in that department. For although it seems like a lull, he says something down in chapter 2 and verse 2. "Ask them," he says, and then in verse 3, who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? And we have. There's people here, many people here who've seen this house in its former glory. "How does it look to you now? Does it not seem to you like nothing? But now be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, O Joshua." These were the historical people back then, and some people feel it refers to the names of the two witnesses to come. Figureheads, people with long shadows. "Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land." That's everybody, declares the Lord, "and work, for I am with you, declares the Lord Almighty. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit remains among you. Do not fear." And then down in verse 9, God says, "The glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty, and in this place I will grant peace." And these are things that happen before Jesus returns. Let's turn to Jeremiah 29. And read about that community that will exist on earth with the focus of the world on it, but it's before Jesus Christ returns. We know about the paradise that will come after that. But in it's chapter 30. I don't seem to be handling the numbers well. Jeremiah 30 and verse 18. This is what the Lord says. "I will restore the fortunes of Jacob's tents and have compassion on his dwellings. The city will be rebuilt on her ruins, and the palace will stand in its proper place. From them will come songs of thanksgiving and the sound of rejoicing. I will add to their numbers, and they will not be decreased. I will bring them honor, and they will not be disdained. Their children will be as in days of old, and their community will be established before me. Then," he says, "I will punish all who oppress them." Wait a minute. He's building this wonderful world and there's people oppressing them? This is not the world tomorrow. This is something that is yet to come. And it's talked about in the book of Haggai. And it's a fine thing to read about before the Feast of Tabernacles comes, because we realize things that have to happen. Verse 21, "Their leader will be one of their own. Their ruler will arise from among them." This is not describing Jesus Christ. This is describing some ruler with a long shadow. "I will bring him near, and he will come close to me." And it sounds like the person might be an unwilling person, because God says, "For who is he who will devote himself to be close to me?" In other words, God's going to do it. "So you will be my people, and I will be your God. See, the storm of the Lord will burst out in wrath." And this is while that community exists. "A driving wind swirling down on the heads of the wicked. The fierce anger of the Lord will not turn back until he fully accomplishes the purposes of his heart. In days to come, you will understand this." We understand so little, don't we? We will understand it as it unfolds. But we have seen history in our church played out. And I've tried to show you today that we owe a great debt to Herbert W. Armstrong. And Herbert W. Armstrong owed a great debt to Elbert Hubbard. I'd love to talk to you about this. I hope you will come see my spoon and that you will read these magazines. And I have many more books at home if you're interested in this kind of thing.